From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The murder of a Palestinian child by Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank produced an angry response from the global community. Palestine's President Mahmoud Abbas denounced the killing as a war crime and pledged to pursue the case at the International Criminal Court.
It's war crime and a crime against humanity. We will not sit silent at all. As long as the settlements continue and the occupation exists, then such crimes will remain and continue. We're preparing a file on this crime and other crimes to immediately take to the International Criminal Court, and no one will stop us from doing so.
Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
Abbas also said that the toddler's death is a result of Tel Aviv emboldening settlers in the occupied territories. Palestinian resistance group Hamas was also quick to decry Israel, calling for a strong response to the tragedy. Israeli leaders, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, censured the violence. Iran's foreign ministry spokeswoman Marzia Afram condemned the Israeli settlers' horrific crime and called on the international community to put an end to such atrocities.
The attack was condemned as a terrorist crime by the UN's envoy for the Middle East peace process, Nikolai Mladenov, as D.N. Penn reports.
Mr. Mladenov called for a full and prompt investigation to bring the perpetrators of what he labeled this terrorist crime to justice. In a statement, he said this heinous murder was carried out for a political objective. The child, whose name was Ali, died and his parents and older brother were critically wounded in the overnight attack, which was strongly condemned by Israeli and Palestinian leaders. Hebrew slogans reportedly were found on one of the homes. Mr. Mladenov, the UN envoy, said the incident reinforced the need for an immediate resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and an end to occupation. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
The continuing Saudi air war against Yemen brought more civilian casualties Friday. Press TV's Kanish Fatima has more.
Saudi Arabia's relentless war on Yemen rages on. Riyadh has conducted fresh air raids against its impoverished neighbor. In the latest attack, Saudi jets dropped bombs on a residential area in Razeh, a district in northwestern Saada province. Local media say at least four people have been killed and five others injured in the attack. The warplanes also targeted a dam and two districts in the western province of Marib. In retaliation, Ansar Allah fighters fired a barrage of rockets into the Saudi territory. The projectiles hit two military bases in the south of the Yoruba Kingdom. Nearly 4,900 Yemenis, mostly civilians, have lost their lives since Saudi Arabia began its devastating onslaught against the poorest Arab country in late March. Hussein al-Bukhaiti, an activist and political commentator, says the relentless Saudi military attacks in Yemen have already led to the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in the country.
The situation in Yemen, the humanitarian situation, is getting every day, by time, is getting worse and worse. It has been now over 4 months the Saudi and their allies blockade. There is no food or fuel getting into Yemen. Hospitals are running out of medical supplies. Many medical centers, especially in Saada, were destroyed. I believe that 90% of the rural medical center in Saada were destroyed by the Saudis. Schools were destroyed. Kids can't go to school now. I mean, we have a crisis with the education now in Yemen. And the Saudi keep bombing and not allowing anything come into Yemen. And if something come, like a few ships sometime will come to Hodeida port or to any other port, they hardly fill some of the need that Yemeni people have.
From Greece, Syriza, the country's ruling leftist party, is facing a major internal crisis after the adoption by majority vote of the latest round of austerity measures imposed on the country by its international creditors. Seeking to resolve the internal dispute, the party's leadership has proposed a snap referendum for as early as this coming Sunday, along with the party Congress in September. Telesur's Cody Weddle spoke with London-based journalist Chris Spanos about how these two mechanisms might work, the divisions within Syriza, and the possibility that new parliamentary elections would be called.
Chris, to start, Tsipras is calling for both a snap referendum within Syriza and a party congress now in September. So explain to us how those two proposals are meant to work.
Well, yes, Tsipras has called for a snap referendum to be held perhaps as soon as this Sunday, in which the party is supposed to vote yes or no on the 86 billion euro bailout agreement that he did agree to earlier in July. How this is supposed to work is curious, because clearly Tsipras has to strengthen his position to move forward. So this referendum could be viewed as a way to get the party behind him to now move under these new circumstances in the face of new bailout conditions and to move forward with a left strategy. The September Congress is supposed to address these deep divisions. Now, I should say that these divisions have existed in the party long before. Last year, in 2014, before Syriza was elected, I was present at that National Congress. And during that party, a very large minority voted to adopt leaving the EU as part of its program. Now, we know that the majority of the party voted to stay in the EU, but all that to say is these divisions run to the core of the party, and it's not so clear that a September Congress will actually overcome these divisions. But now the question is will it be used to mobilize new party members who are more willing and able to carry out the requirements of a new austerity deal? And none of these are clear, because from Tsipras's point of view, who has clearly identified and invested in his position of the bailout agreement, he believes Syriza has caused a crisis in the neoliberal hegemonic bloc of the creditors, while the left bloc of Syriza believe that the agreement has itself betrayed the, as you said, the anti-austerity roots of the party.
And Chris, there are even some talks of early elections in Greece. Is that possible? And explain that to us.
Well, it is possible. Tsipras doesn't have very many options. He has to strengthen his position in the party, or otherwise he may be forced to call new elections if he doesn't have support. Now, that will then open up another chapter in the saga of this drama, because the timing of new elections will then, the outcome of that will depend on the opposition party's ability to regroup from the previous former pro-austerity parties to the far-right Golden Dawn parties. But it is a possibility.
Earlier this month, the U.S. and Cuba reopened their diplomatic missions for the first time in more than a half century, with some on the right calling the move a betrayal of anti-Castro groups in the U.S., and some on the left calling it a betrayal of the revolution. All agree that the changes will have a profound impact on Cuba in general. Rosemary Mealy is a journalist, educator, and activist. She just returned from a visit to Cuba, her first since the announcement earlier this year that Washington and Havana would reestablish diplomatic ties. She spoke with CPR's Bernard White via telephone Friday.
Rosemary Mealy is also an author who wrote the book Fidel and Malcolm, a story about a meeting that they had in the Teresa Hotel back when I was in junior high school. I remember being in junior high school and walking down after school to the Teresa Hotel to see Fidel. I mean, all of Harlem was abuzz with Fidel. And so we, giggling junior high school students on our own, walked down to 125th Street just to see what this was all about. Rosemary, hello.
Good morning. How are you, Bernard? You're dating yourself. That was 1960.
I know. I was going to Frederick Douglass Junior High School on 139th Street in Atlantic.
Wow.
And we were about five or six of us walked down. We just had to see what this was all about.
So that was somewhere between September the 16th through the 19th of September 1960. Wow, that's amazing.
So you've just returned from Cuba. You know, one of the things that I've been talking about here is that, you know, the United States is so large and so powerful in its ability to subvert and rearrange societies. And I was wondering, how are the Cubans going to deal with this ability that the U.S. has? And I know that I went to Cuba back in 83 after the invasion of Grenada by the United States. And I was just fascinated. I went with Alambe Brath. I was just fascinated by all of the things that I saw there, and the whole way that they put people first as opposed to profits first, as opposed to corporations first. And I'm wondering, I know you've been there too. What kind of changes have you seen?
Well, you know, first let me thank you so much for inviting me to come on the program today, and I'm really glad that you're using this technological medium to do that, because it's reaching not just New York, but around the world, quote unquote. So that's important. And that technology is one of the main things that the Cubans need and stress more than anything, that the reopening of diplomatic relations. And when the right-wing Congress lifts this blockade, then it's that those are the kinds of resources that they're looking to take advantage of, in addition to selling the incredible amount of technology that they have been able to amass and develop in despite the more than 50 years of the U.S. imposed blockade. But I guess first I want to start off by saying, you know, who the group was. As you know, the late Reverend Lucius Walker of the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organizations had done some very creative things over the past 20-plus years by actually challenging the travel ban through a concept known as a IFCO Pastors for Peace caravan to Cuba, where this caravan travels all over the United States and then it crosses the border into Mexico, where it challenges the blockade by taking symbolic material aid to the country. So the delegation that I was on, we're doing something. I'm on the board of IFCO, so we're trying to do something different by, in addition to people who want to go on the caravan and challenge the travel ban, which is still in place, we're organizing people, what we call people-to-people delegations to Cuba. So this group that I took was actually 17 folk from around the country who had met most of them. I think probably more than a half of them had never traveled to Cuba. So for them, a lot of them said, we want to go to Cuba to see it before the U.S. gets there. And that, you know, that's kind of like the mentality of a lot of people who have not been, because they are assuming that with the advent of reestablished ties and diplomatic relations, that that's somehow going to transform the country into, quote unquote, a capitalist paradise, another capitalist paradise in the Caribbean. So when you ask me the changes, because I lived there during the time when the Soviets left, which was incredible, like the latter part of the 80s, when everything just, people thought that the country was going to fall apart. You know, it's called the special period where things were just really bad, Bernard. I mean, but the people were so resilient, you know, found ways to survive, started up community gardens to raise food, created, transformed those old cars even more so into things that rolled by using parts of the lotter cars from the Soviet Union and the Polskis from Poland, and just recreated a whole new concept of automobile technology. So, and then I've been, over the years, I've been there since, but this time coming, I was just amazed at the transformation process that's occurring in the country, even before the United States had made overtures to reestablish ties. Some of the economic innovations that have occurred in the country over the past 10 years, and that is to transform the society to the, in the context of being able to allow the individuals to and cooperatives to develop, to quote unquote privatize a lot of the industry within the, particularly in the tourism industry, that's going to bring in capital, which that in turn allows people to not only be able to provide, to be self-sustaining, but also to be creative in terms of integrating themselves into the tourism industry. So I'm talking about the private restaurants, which they're incredible. I mean, you don't get, I mean, we're talking about restaurants that serve 4-star meals for lunch and dinner. And so also the cooperatives that are being developed, there are cooperatives that are being developed that are construction cooperatives, where workers are controlling the cooperatives, and they go, one in particular, they go out into the community, they see things that have not, are not complete in terms of construction, they approach the owner, they propose a budget, they develop a strategy, a construction strategy, they go ahead and they build the building, they repair the buildings, the houses, and then the money that comes back into the cooperative then is distributed to the cooperative members, and they're able then to buy more materials and continue the process. And this is, I mean, if they had a, if Home Depot was there, they would rake, up, but they, you know, they found ways to, they're inventive. So, so you see a lot of a lot of privatizing of the tourism industry, i.e., in the restaurants, like I said, as well as privatization via cooperatives in terms of the collective approach, wherein the country still maintains free health care, free education. And that's just the bulwark of what the revolution promised, and it continues. So with Cuba establishing, with the United States reestablished diplomatic relations with Cuba, in all of the discussions that we had, even with individuals as well as very few people, as a matter of fact, from the party, but everyone pretty much supports, you know, what the foreign minister stated when the flag was raised at the reopening of the embassy in Washington. And everybody realizes that normalization is going to be a long and a complicated process, and it's going to require what the Cubans say, willpower on the part of both parties, meaning on the part of the United States as well as them, but always with a recognition that they are a sovereign nation, and that that sovereignty has to be respected, pretty much like what the Vietnamese have said, and were able to we were able to see a joint resolution from the Vietnamese not too long ago out of Washington, where the United States government acknowledged in a written document that it would respect the differences in the sovereignty of the two nations. But I mean, even before we get there, there's still other things on the table. I mean, there's Guantanamo. That's an issue that has to be resolved. So getting back to what we saw and what we experienced, I was really impressed, of course, with the level of commitment that people have to maintaining their revolution. But maybe not, you know, not in the, in the sense, the traditional sense of our concept in this country of what is revolutionary. They, I mean, they're talking about maintaining the level of the quality of life. The revolution was really about maintaining humanity, or encouraging, ensuring humanity, survival of humanity. And you see that. You still see that. It's very much a, it is a part of the, of that whole revolutionary process. So I think that we also had an opportunity to visit the Biotechnological Center in Havana, which is just amazing to see what they have been able to do in the past 50 years in terms of scientific development and also, you know, finding cures for sickle cell, finding a rest for sickle cell anemia. Making sure that finding vaccines for lung cancer, the whole issue around diabetes. I mean, all kinds of of things that are going on in that country in terms of health care, that they have been able to market on the international market, which is something that we in this country don't think about, because when we think about the restoration of diplomatic relationship between Cuba and the United States, we in general, the masses of public opinion, think that we're talking about taking the consumerism and fast food restaurants and things like that into the country, instead of thinking about what that country has produced that could be beneficial to us here in the United States. And I think that was one of an important concept and idea that we heard from everyone. What does Cuba have to give to the U.S. as opposed to what does the U.S. bring into Cuba? You mean they talk about what they need is aspect. They want to further develop their agricultural system. So therefore, they need the machinery. You know, so those are the kinds of things that they need. And I think that the blockade would allow them then to trade with the U.S. around those kind of things. They need paint, you know, for. There's everybody who comes back, those who have a lot of criticism of Cuba, they talk about the dilapidated buildings and the no-paint buildings and what have you, without even thinking that for 50 years they haven't been able to buy paint on the world market. You know, any country that would sell them would be penalized for trading with them. So, you know, it's those kind of things. But, you know, the other positive thing about Havana is that area and many parts of Cuba have been declared by UNESCO as historic sites. So, you know, money has been coming in from the UNESCO, where they've been able to rebuild a lot of the buildings along the seaside, or what's known as the Malecon. The tourism is clearly there. I mean, people are there from all over the world except here. You know, we met Germans, we met people from Canada, we met people from Australia, the Caribbean, a lot of folks traveling there from the Caribbean, because it's a people nation, you know. And so, you know, some of the negative sides about it, you know, naturally, you know, we as quote-unquote progressive people, in addition to lauding the positives, we also look, you know, we also have to acknowledge, as the Cubans themselves acknowledge, some of the issues that they have to deal with. And one of the issues that they clearly discuss is the fact that there is a disparity between the black Cuban and the disparity in terms of access, between black Cubans and the white Cubans, many of them who get remittance from Miami, wherein, as you know, when the revolution occurred, black folks didn't leave because black folks in Cuba were the ones who benefited mostly from the revolution. But now what you find is with the privatization of, particularly in the tourism industry, the restaurants and things, many of them are not, the Cuban of African descent, they don't have the capital to amass or to engage in some of the privatization of some of the things that are taking place. So they acknowledge that, and so that's an issue. There's open discussions in the country about racism. There's open discussions about the possibility or the question of how a new class could emerge. So, but you know, they're talking about this, and once it's discussed at the party level, and then it comes down to the mass level, they're talking about how images are presented on the television. You know, still have some of those old images of blacks still being the underclass, who's the most, you know, the criminal and what have you. You still see some of that in the TV shows, but at the same time, you see campaigns on television that really raise those kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. So, in essence, that's basically what I saw, and I saw more open discussion around those issues than what we may have seen in the past. Let me just put it like that.
Uh-huh. Well, that's certainly how you begin to resolve those issues, through the process of discussion, a dialectical process.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, my thinking, and you just changed it or just added something to it. was that the United States, given its massiveness, would be applying pressure on Cuba to have it conform to what it wanted to be. But you raise the question that the issue that Cuba, folks coming from the United States and going to Cuba, they might influence people who come to Cuba that life doesn't have to be the way it is in the United States.
Absolutely. And I think that, I mean, we have always known that that is one reason why there was this travel ban that denied U.S. citizens the right to travel there. Because if you go there and once you see, you don't see any billboards, you know, you don't see any massive poverty, you know, you don't see massive, you know, you might see a few people, you know, begging, but you don't see massive hunger. You don't see massive poverty. I mean, you do see here's one of the problems. And if you just go to Havana, naturally for any urban center, that becomes the pinnacle of where you see some of a lot of the negatives, because people are leaving people over the years have left the countryside and moved into the urban center. So there's a housing shortage there, okay? And that's one reason why the government now, they're giving people land to relocate back to the countryside and do farming, you know. And that's like a really giving you land to set up your own cooperatives to move back to develop the country through around the issue of agriculture. I mean, so yeah, you see in some parts of the country, in some parts of the city of Havana in particular, you see a disparity in housing, but at the same level, you know that people are eating, you know. Nobody is starving, quote-unquote, in Cuba. You see what I'm saying? So that's an important. But as you move out into the countryside, people are working. You still see oxen pulling plows and things like that, and that's where the technology comes in of needing to be able to purchase equipment in order to develop further the agriculture. Or you go to Varadero, which is one of the showcases for tourism. I mean, Varadero looks like any other tourist city in any other Caribbean country. You know, it's developed, it's very well developed, but Cubans live in Varadero. It's not a city of tourism. You know, it's not off limits to Cubans. So the culture is so intact, Bernard, as you know, it's alive. I mean, the art is just flourishing. I mean, painters, writers, the poetry, the music, the dance. I mean, it just goes on forever. I mean, the culture, and they've done so much for young people. I mean, it's a young society. That's the other thing. And young people, you know, they're enjoying themselves. This time of the year, school is out. So naturally, everybody is hanging out and they're having, you know, they're enjoying themselves. And that's another thing. And when you go there, that's something people here can learn. When you go there, you talk to people, they have hope. Can you imagine that? I mean, they believe that things are going to get better, you know, and wherein we have lost hope. I mean, when I say we, I'm mm-hmm. talking about the collective
yes.
psychology of people in this country. I mean, when you have somebody like Donald Trump running for president in the polls, that shows that people in this country clearly have lost hope, you know, in any kind of theoretical understanding or in intellectualism or anything like that. I mean, it's just amazing.
Some have lost hope and some have lost their minds.
Right. Yes, yes. So two things I would encourage the listeners. Number one is to really keep pushing this Congress to lift this blockade and embargo, whatever term you want to use. That's very important. And then secondly, to use one of the 11 reasons, legitimate ways that you can travel there.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.